you can see the contrast with the art world, where because galleries can apply for grants, you have incredibly rich visual arts communities in Toronto. And you have whole, you know, communities that have their completely distinctive spaces and places, and they do very well. If public support, you know, can be justified in Canada, then they have to include bookstores. They just have to.
So there you have it, my interview with Charlie and Jesse Huskin of the St. The Rosedale Library. Please check the St. blog.wordpress.com. Often support independent booksellers. Consider the responsibility that our communities, our municipalities, our different levels of government have to considering the value of independent bookstores. Consider that. Think about that. And please, you know, also continue to support community made radio, because it is also everything is connected. I can't talk anymore because my show is done, but I could talk for a long time about how everything is connected in terms of community supported projects. Please stay tuned. Free Speech Radio News is up next after some PSAs, and then we'll go to Democracy Now, and then my favorite jazz show is on, My Kind of Jazz, a little bit later at 2 o'clock. Have a great day, everybody, and please meet me back here next Thursday at 10 a.m.
CFRU and the Guelph Jazz Festival invites you to a silent dance party as part of Nuit Blanche. The silent dance party is an all-night radio-based multi-DJ dance party. You won't want to miss it. Three DJs simultaneously playing music at all times, each broadcasting to a different radio frequency, including CFRU, featuring a rotating cast of DJs playing salsa, electro, P-funk, swing, dubstep, hip-hop, and more, and it's all free. Portable radios and headphones will be provided to attendees. You'll be able to choose which of the three DJs you want to dance to by adjusting the dial. Don't miss this night of freeform dancing, where you can only try to guess which DJ the dancer next to you is listening to. If you don't like what you hear, change the channel, change it again. The event will take place from midnight to sunrise at the Royal Bank parking lot, next to the E-Bar on Quebec Street, on Saturday, September 11th, 2010, and will feature the DJ talents of Guelph Jazz Festival performers and organizers, along with all of your favorite local DJs. Alcohol will not be sold at this event. Coffee may be available. Or, if you feel like staying home, be sure to tune in to CFRU 93.3 FM from midnight to 4 a.m. on September 11th to hear the DJs in action. We'll be broadcasting live from the party to radios everywhere within our broadcast room. For more information on Nuit Blanche and the Guelph Jazz Festival, check out www.guelphjazzfestival.com.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 25th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, investigations into the cause of the BP oil disaster continue today, with a focus on what went wrong in the hours and days surrounding the April explosion. A UN study looking into the effects of oil spills in the Niger Delta comes under fire for using data from a multinational oil company. And 5 years after Hurricane Katrina, tens of thousands of homeowners remain displaced. We'll look at a multi-billion-dollar government program charged with helping homeowners rebuild.
this shortchanged a lot of people.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Primary results are still coming in for several races around the country. The most important and surprising of the undecided races is the Republican Senate race in Alaska. There, Sarah Palin-backed Joe Miller holds a 2,000-vote lead over incumbent Lisa Murkowski with 98% of the precincts counted. But elections officials say the final results could take up to a week to determine, mainly because thousands of absentee ballots remain to be counted. There's also a virtual three-way tie in Vermont's Democratic gubernatorial primary. The seat is currently held by a Republican. Campaign funding is a perennial issue in politics, and this year a number of high-profile self-finance candidates have seen victory, namely in California and Connecticut. In Florida's primary yesterday, mixed results. Self-financed outsider candidate Rick Scott won the Republican nomination for governor over a longtime party insider, but a wealthy Democratic challenger for the state's U.S. Senate seat lost. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, Sean Canan reports for FSRN.
Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum had the support of virtually the entire Florida Republican Party establishment. McCollum served in Congress for 20 years, beginning with the election of Ronald Reagan, and was a House manager of President Bill Clinton's impeachment trial. But that wasn't enough for McCollum to beat a former healthcare executive, Rick Scott, who bashed the attorney general for being a career politician throughout the campaign and during his victory speech last night.
I want to thank every voter who went to the polls and cast a vote to end politics as usual in Tallahassee and turn our state around.
Scott spent more than four times as much as McCollum during the campaign. Scott will face Democratic nominee Alex Sink and nine alternative party and non-party candidates in November. On the Democratic side, the self-financed candidate for U.S. Senate lost his race. Representative Kendrick Meek beat billionaire Jeff Green, who spent $20 million of his own money on his campaign. Meek's biggest challengers in November will be Republican Marco Rubio and Governor Charlie Crist, who is running as an independent. Sean Canan, FSRN, Tampa.
Money may not be the only factor playing into Rick Scott's defeat of Bill McCollum. In the final weeks of the campaign, McCollum changed his previously moderate stance and proposed an Arizona-style immigration law for Florida. Fernand Amandi of the research firm Benedictson and Amandi says this may have alienated Republican Hispanic voters.
The county with the biggest number of Hispanic Republicans, of course, being Miami-Dade County, underperformed at a level when you look at how the rest of the state performed. In Dade County, you had less than 17% turnout versus the rest of the state, where the average was about 21.
The immigration issue could also come into play in Arizona, where a large Latino population resides. There, John McCain defended his seat against Tea Party candidate J.D. Hayworth. Arturo Vargas is executive director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. He says Arizona's new immigration law could usher in a new prominence for Latino voters in the state.
There are a vast number of efforts that are being put on the ground to register Latinos and to make sure Latinos show up to the polls in November. SB 1070 is serving as a rallying cry for the Arizona community, which in past elections has not performed as well in terms of turnout as other electorates in other states, such as California and Florida or Texas.
Vargas says his organization conducted a recent poll of Latino voters in four states, and for the first time in the last 25 years, immigration was given as the voters' most important issue. In a victory for India's local tribal people, the government has refused to grant UK-based Vedanta Group approval to mine bauxite in the Indian state of Orissa. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani reports.
The government's decision comes a week after a panel set up to examine the project described it as illegal and recommended its rejection. In its report, the panel said that the company has violated environmental and forest laws and even accused state government officials of colluding with the company. They also said the project poses a serious threat to the survival of tribal people in the area, who have officially been recognized as primitive tribal groups. Jairam Ramesh is Environment Minister.
This is a serious issue. Serious issues have been brought out. And we have to take a clear stand. We can't waffle any longer.
Local tribal people and environmental groups welcomed the decision. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Dozens of girls in Afghanistan have been hospitalized in what could be a case of intentional poisoning at their school. According to Al Jazeera, officials believe fundamentalist groups like the Taliban have been gassing girls' schools in order to discourage attendance. An investigation is underway. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. BP officials gave testimony in Houston again today during the U.S. Coast Guard and Bureau of Energy Management's joint investigation into the disaster. Commission members are trying to find out why the BOP, or blowout preventer, failed. That was the device that should have stopped the flow of oil had it been working. BP's Vice President for Drilling and Completions, Harry Tierens, indicated that Transocean made changes to the blowout preventer that hindered their efforts to shut off the flow of oil following the deadly explosion.
There was a period of time where Transocean were looking for what was referred to as points of interest or places of interest on the BOP stack. And if that time had not been necessary, it could have expedited a faster response to the operation of the BOP.
Commission member Jason Matthews with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management wanted to know if BP was aware of changes that could have affected safety. He asked Terrence to read from notes he recorded on April 25th, 5 days after the rig exploded.
My concern right now is that Transocean made, possibly, an uncontrolled change to the system locally on the rig. It does not appear at this time that they have a controlled process for this change on something which is safety critical.
And you confirmed today that that log, you still think that's a safety critical element?
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the President's National Oil Spill Commission met today to look at how to prevent and respond to future spills. Much of the emphasis during today's hearing was placed on how to alter the regulatory structure to prevent a disaster like the BP oil spill from happening again. Michael Lawson has more from Washington.
In the aftermath of the BP oil spill, shortcomings in the regulatory and drilling approval process appeared as part of the problem. The National Oil Spill Commission, created in May by executive order, seeks to analyze possible changes to offshore drilling policies. Offshore drilling leases and production is governed by the Outer Continental Shelf Land Act of 1953, or OCSLA. Meg Caldwell is executive director of the Center for Ocean Solutions at Stanford University. She said, as written, OCSLA promotes increasing oil and gas production without significant environmental review.
OCSLA should be reformed to pull the nation's regulatory framework for OCS activities into the 21st century.
Caldwell recommends amending OCSLA to give government agencies with environmental knowledge a greater role in cooperating with the newly formed Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which replaces the Minerals Management Service. Caldwell also said a 30-day environmental review requirement wasn't enough time to properly assess environmental risk. Jane Lipchenko serves as administrator of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She agreed the deadline was limiting, considering the resources available.
I was pleased to see discussion of the time frames in many of the discussions to date, because those are problematic for multiple reasons. And one of them is that it really constrains what's possible. The other is that if you don't have a lot of resources to have people deployed to do lots of different ongoing things that are happening simultaneously, it's a very real challenge.
Participants also discussed separating the two functions of the new Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, approving leases, and conducting environmental reviews. Nancy Sutley serves as chair of the White House's Council on Environmental Quality and is ultimately responsible for enforcing environmental review policies. She says separating the two would be a step in the right direction, but the sheer amount of information presents its own challenge.
Questioned about, what would happen if this was all sent off to an independent agency on the regulatory side. So I honestly, I don't know the answer to that, but I think those are the things that you'd want to consider. Mm.
The National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling is expected to conduct more hearings before issuing its findings by January 2011. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
And as residents in the Gulf continue to feel the effects of the massive BP oil disaster, another region of the world is struggling with ongoing damage from oil spills. In the Niger Delta in Western Africa, nearly double the amount of the oil that has spilled into the Gulf, or 9 million barrels, has been gushing into the region over the past half century, according to Amnesty International. Much of that is from Royal Dutch Shell. Now a UN report investigating damage from the spills is coming under fire. Community and environmental groups say that the UN's environment program has used figures from Shell Oil and the Nigerian government in order to put blame on local militants for the cause of the spills rather than the multinational corporation. In a statement released on August 23rd, the UN agency doing the study acknowledged the figures come from Shell and Nigeria's government, but say they do not represent the results of the study, which is ongoing. To find out more, we called Audrey Gochran. She's the director of Amnesty International's Global Thematic Issues Program and joins us from London. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, let's get a scale of the damage. The National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency of Nigeria has reported more than 3,000 oil spills in the Niger Delta region in the last 4 years alone. How much oil are we talking about, and what has been the effect on local communities?
It's a good question, and I think the answer is one of the reasons why the UN figures have caused such controversy. Nobody really knows exactly how much oil has been spilled in the Delta because there's no credible means of investigating each and every oil spill and measuring the amount of oil that is discharged. We do know thousands of oil spills have occurred over the 50 years that the oil companies have been operating there. The National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency has obviously given a very high figure even for the last number of years. Most people would say that's underreporting because it's so hard to identify every spill. The best estimate that we had seen was put together by a group of experts who said if you total all the oil that's discharged in the Delta, year on year, it's like an Exxon Valdez occurring every year.
So annually in that region, the same amount of oil that was spilled in Exxon Valdez is going into that region?
If you total all the oil that is discharged from oil spills and all other sources, it that's one way of describing the impact or the effect.
And that takes us to this report from the UN Environment Program. It's still unfinished. It's a three-year study looking into these spills. Mike Cowing, who is heading up the investigation, he drew attention when earlier this month in Geneva, he said, and this is according to The Guardian who covered it, that 90% of spills could be blamed on vandalism and attacks on oil lines. That's a figure consistent with Shell, and it would also excuse Shell from much of the blame. Now, Shell has funded this study, is that right?
As far as I'm aware, Shell is funding the United Nations Environment Program study.
And what's the significance of that figure when he says that 90% of the spills could be blamed on local vandalism?
Well, I think that figure completely lacks credibility. The figure comes from officially from the Nigerian regulatory agencies. It's a figure that's been long disputed. It's based on the investigation into the causes of oil spills, which are hotly disputed in the Niger Delta, and Amnesty itself has looked at this and investigated the issue of how oil spills are investigated, and the conclusion that we reached was that the oil companies themselves are effectively quite often the ones to decide what the cause of the spill was. Now, given they're also the ones who would be liable if it was found to be due to negligence or faulty equipment, allowing the oil companies so much control over saying what the cause was is a clear conflict of interest.
The study is, as I understand it, due to be released in 2011. Are there any indications so far that after this latest criticism, the UN will take into consideration other sources when coming out with the draft or the final report?
Well, we would hope and strongly recommend that UNEP focus on the assessments it's made about the impact of oil pollution, so the impact on the soil, on the water, on the health of communities in Ogoniland, and provide scientific evidence to support that. But we would be very, very dismayed if they quoted figures
on the causation of oil spills, which they have not, by their own admission, investigated, or if they quoted these highly unreliable figures that they've that were quoted in Geneva earlier last week. Produce the photograph that shows how it's been cut, the pipe was cut. Produce the video footage evidence that you have that shows what was going on. And it's very telling to us that the oil companies rarely, if ever, do this.
Audrey Gochran is the director of Amnesty International's Global Thematic Issues Program. She joined us to talk about a UN study that's looking at the damage in a certain part of the Niger Delta from oil spills. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Five years after the flood caused by the failure of the levees in New Orleans, tens of thousands of homeowners remain displaced. The Louisiana Recovery Authority says that as of August, its Road Home program had spent over $9 billion to help homeowners rebuild. It was the largest disaster recovery operation in U.S. history. Zoe Sullivan has more about the problems with the program and lessons that could be learned for the future.
The New Orleans City Council chamber was near capacity during recent hearings on the Road Home program. State officials testified, and residents told stories of frustration and anguish. In this exchange, Neil Abramson, chair of the State Hurricane Recovery Committee, challenged the Disaster Recovery Unit's Lara Robertson on whether, 5 years after the storm, residents would finally get money to rebuild.
The pipeline is beginning to open up for us because we've overcome so many hurdles to get this project rolled out.
I haven't seen the pipeline open up if we got 12,000 people stuck in the pipeline. I think we're looking at this as the traditional hurricane recovery program. That's the problem. The traditional hurricane recovery programs haven't worked. Let's be untraditional and get one to work.
Many residents have struggled to get funding through the program, including Vanessa Billiott, a lifetime resident of Plaquemines Parish, the southernmost part of Louisiana. Her home was flattened by Katrina.
They shortchanged a lot of people. Now they're talking about sending them to the different parishes. Honey, if it goes to the parishes, I know in my parish, we won't see it.
Billiott and other residents have encountered problems with one of the most controversial aspects of the Road Home program, the decision to use the lower value of a home before the storm or the cost to repair it.
I explained to him, I told him, I said, look, I appealed my pre-storm value repeatedly. And then the lady kept telling me, they say, well, there's nothing we can do because, you know, you have to go with the lesser, you know, of the amount. Okay, so I said, but my problem is the pre-storm value isn't going to help me with the rebuilding costs.
When the Road Home program was first rolled out, it would award up to $150,000 for rebuilding or repair costs. In August 2006, the program adopted the lower value calculation. According to the research group PolicyLink, this change left about 80% of New Orleans homeowners and nearly 70% of homeowners elsewhere in the state without enough money to rebuild. A federal judge issued a temporary injunction on August 16th, halting the use of this formula. The court said that the impact of the formula was likely discriminatory, a point that could support a lawsuit filed by housing advocates against HUD, the Louisiana Recovery Authority, and the initial Road Home contractor, Virginia-based ICF International. State officials argue that this injunction doesn't represent a final decision on the case. Robin Keegan is the executive director of the Louisiana Office of Community Development, which has been responsible for the Road Home program since Governor Jindal took office in 2008. Keegan criticized the Stafford Act, which regulates government disaster response.
The rules at the federal level do not work for catastrophic disasters, and they don't need to be implemented. We need new tools. We need new rules. So the Stafford Act, we've been fighting for years for multiple changes within the Stafford Act.
While Keegan placed blame on federal policy, advocates have also criticized her agency and others responsible for implementing the program. One of the most vocal critics is Melanie Ehrlich, a professor of biochemistry at Tulane Medical Center. Ehrlich lives in Gentilly, one of the neighborhoods hardest hit by the floods. Seeing her neighbors wrangle with bureaucracy as they tried to rebuild prompted Ehrlich to co-found the Citizens Road Home Action Team, or CHAT, Ehrlich said Road Home applicants were often misinformed or forced to provide the same documents multiple times. She said that to improve management of disaster recovery programs, the federal government has to be involved.
What needs to be done is to make government work for the people and for someone in the federal government, because this is federal money, to take charge and say, yes, we will exercise oversight. HUD, the HUD Office of the Inspector General has investigated complaints, a tiny number of complaints of applicant fraud. They have investigated nothing about the scandalous treatment of tens of thousands of road home applicants in this program.
Officials at the hearing said that at least 12,000 people are still waiting to get funds through one segment of the road home program. Across the city, about 50,000 empty homes and lots still blight New Orleans landscape. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And in other news from New Orleans, a new investigation has found that in the days after Hurricane Katrina, officials at the New Orleans Police Department authorized officers to shoot looters. The investigation comes from ProPublica, the Times-Picayune, and Frontline, and draws on on-the-record recollections of current and past members of the police department who say the orders led to an atmosphere of confusion in which 11 civilians were shot, only one of whom was allegedly stealing goods at the time. Human rights advocates have issued a report that says that the U.S. government is failing to protect immigrants in detention from sexual abuse. The report from Human Rights Watch follows an announcement that a guard at an all-female detention center in Texas has been charged with official repression and unlawful restraint for allegedly fondling women in his custody. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
Officer Dunn faces 5 misdemeanor charges for allegedly fondling female detainees' breasts, buttocks, and crotch while he frisked them. Dunn worked at the T. Don Hutto Detention Center near Austin, Texas, and was employed by Corrections Corporation of America, which owns and operates the Facility for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE. ACLU Deputy Legal Director Vanita Gupta welcomes the charges against Dunn, but she notes that while he violated a contract clause, he did not run afoul of federal guidelines against sexual assault in detention centers.
It goes to show that the guidelines that ICE has really need to be significantly beefed up to be meaningful to prevent this kind of tragedy from happening again.
This is the second reported incident at Hutto in 3 years, and it could be just the tip of the iceberg for assaults occurring in detention centers. Advocates say many women never file a complaint if they're assaulted while detained, and once they're deported, they have little legal recourse. Now, Human Rights Watch has issued a report that says ICE needs to revise regulations to prevent assaults from occurring in the first place. Megan Rode is the report's author.
We are interested in seeing them revise the rules around pat searches generally. There are virtually no limits placed on when a pat search can happen in immigration detention, despite the fact that these are civil detainees.
Human Rights Watch has also called on ICE to ban guards from searching detainees of a different gender. They want the Justice Department to improve its prosecution rates for abuse and assaults in detention. And they say Congress should demand more disclosure of such assaults. Rode says ICE has discussed the revised regulations with advocates, but it's unclear when it plans to implement them.
We have thousands of women at risk, women and men at risk, so they need to sort of play catch up on getting these standards into place.
This year, ICE expects to detain about 400,000 immigrants, and almost 10% of them will be women. Renee Feltz, Free Speech Radio News.
The winners of the federal Race to the Top education grants were announced on Tuesday. The program is supposed to reward states that are aggressively tackling school reform agendas, but the program is receiving criticism. Rural areas say the requirements don't make sense for their schools, and some inner-city educators say the program is biased against them, too. Tanya Snyder reports.
9 of the 10 Phase 2 winners are east of the Mississippi. So are the first-round winners, Tennessee and Delaware. Some say the Race to the Top competition is a poor fit for Western and rural school systems. Armando Villaseca is the Education Commissioner of Vermont. Though he's in New England, his state is heavily rural, and he led an effort by rural education officials to let the feds know that the system isn't working for them.
Vermont did not apply for either of the two rounds. We made a conscious decision that this may have been a good application process or a good process for other states, but it was not helping us move in the direction that we felt that we were moving in.
Villaseca says he understands that dense urban areas face